From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. New research by Pew finds Michigan is favoring payday lenders over less expensive low-income lenders.
So that's why in Michigan, the average interest rate for payday loans is 369%.
A neighborhood of homes built by General Motors in Pontiac is part of a national competition. It was chosen because of its history and its reflection of the city today.
You have Latino, you have African American, you have old, you have young, you have gay, you have straight. You literally have a microcosm of the rich diversity of Pontiac.
We have an interview with the independent candidate running for attorney general.
My question is, who's doing the work of the people? Consumer protection, actually getting resources to fight violent crime, opioid addiction, identity theft. That's what I want to do.
We'll also talk to him about how he managed to get on the ballot. And Dustin Dwyer continues his report on Michigan and the land. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. There are major statewide races this November. Among them is the race for Michigan Attorney General. Today and tomorrow, we're talking with the candidates about their top priorities. Today, Chris Graveline joins us. He's running for Attorney General as an independent.
My question is, who's doing the work of the people? Consumer protection, actually getting resources to fight violent crime, opioid addiction, identity theft. That's what I want to do.
That's later in the hour, but first, payday lenders and auto title lenders can charge very high interest rates or fees. There are other options for people with low credit scores. They're called consumer finance companies. But an analysis of these operations by the Pew Charitable Trusts finds the installment loans offered by consumer finance companies often cost a lot more than the stated interest rates. Joining us now is Alex Horowitz. He's Senior Research Officer of Pew's Consumer Finance Project. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Your report indicates these consumer finance company loans are lower than the payday lenders, that the monthly rates are usually more affordable. They are a fairly stable way of getting out of that loan debt. What other advantages over payday lenders or auto title lenders are there with these installment lenders?
Installment loans from consumer finance companies cost about 3 to 4 times less than payday and auto title loans. They also have affordable payments. So we identified a data set of more than 200,000 installment loans. 85% of them had payments of 5% or less of a borrower's paycheck. In the payday loan market, those loans have payments that are usually more than 1/3 of a borrower's next paycheck, which explains why people take out a 2-week loan, but on average, they end up in debt for about half the year.
Hmm. You also note that state laws allow these consumer finance companies to add some extra fees and sell some ancillary services. What are those extra costs to the loans?
So most state laws allow consumer finance companies to sell credit insurance. Credit insurance is a low-value product, meaning rather few of the dollars that are paid in premiums are actually spent on benefits for borrowers. So this is low-value insurance, but it drives up the cost of borrowing by more than 1/3. In Michigan specifically, small installment loans are mostly unavailable. State law caps interest rates at a low level, but it's given payday lenders special treatment. So that's why in Michigan, the average interest rate for payday loans is 369%. But installment lenders who could make these loans at prices 3 to 4 times lower are not offering this small credit in Michigan at lower prices. Ohio, meanwhile, acted this summer to rein in payday loans and reform that market. So credit is still widely available, but at prices about 3 times lower than what Michigan families pay.
Let's get back to the costs that are added to the loan. How much could this insurance and these fees that they add to these loans from the consumer finance companies add to the cost of a loan? Let's say the interest rate is set at this. That's what you think you're paying, but what you end up paying is what?
So credit insurance on average raises the cost of a loan by 37%. So a borrower may sign up for a loan. The average for installment loans under $1,500 is a borrower signs up for a loan with an APR of 70%.
Wow.
But what they get is effectively a loan with an APR of 90% when you factor in the credit insurance. So 70% sounds very high. It depends on the term and the size of the loan, whether that actually ends up being expensive. Because, for example, a $400 three-month loan for $50, that's around 70% APR. But the installment loans can end up being more expensive than what they look like in the contracts because of credit insurance.
Still, at the same time, as you noted, a lot cheaper than the payday loans. Compared to surrounding states, there are not a lot of these consumer finance companies in Michigan. Illinois, for instance, has 360 branches for every 100,000 people. Michigan has 29 per 100,000 people. Do we know why Michigan has so fewer?
It's because Michigan sets low interest rate limits for loans like this that make them unprofitable. But they've given payday lenders special treatment. So payday lenders don't have to abide by those interest rate limits. So for the most part, installment lenders have stayed out of Michigan, except for the large dollar lenders that offer big loans of, say, $5,000 to $10,000, even $15,000, made to people with relatively high credit scores. But smaller installment lenders who do $400,000, $500,000 loans have stayed out of Michigan because they can't operate profitably there, even though the legislature has given payday lenders special treatment that lets them charge an average of 369%.
Tell me about the reforms that Ohio implemented and how it might have helped its low credit score population.
Ohio got reforms exactly right. A large bipartisan majority passed a bill this July that will bring down the prices of payday loans to about three times lower than where they are in Michigan, but still let lenders charge enough to operate profitably. They also are enabling competition from lower cost lenders by enabling, say, small installment lenders to come into the state and make these loans too at a price that may be lower than where payday lenders end up. So in Michigan, borrowing $400 for 3 months, a consumer would typically pay more than $300 in fees. But under Ohio's new law, borrowing $400 for 3 months would be $109.
Do we have any idea why the legislature has decided that payday lenders should get all this special treatment?
In 35 states, payday lenders operate, and they usually have a carve-out from state interest rate limits. That was an experiment in the 1990s to see whether making payday loans available would help people get through tough times, but that's a failed experiment. As it turned out, payday loans harm consumers because when they take out a two-week loan that takes up more than one-third of their paycheck, they end up in debt for about half the year at interest rates consistently over 300%. Most payday loan borrowers pay more in fees than they originally got in credit.
Your report gave several recommendations for state legislators to consider. We don't have time to go through everything, but hit a couple of the top spots for us.
Sure. State legislatures can protect consumers by essentially doing what Ohio did. That means lower prices, affordable payments, and reasonable time to repay. If legislatures enact laws that hit those three while keeping credit available, then they've made consumers better off without a trade-off in access to credit. Ohio also was able to avoid large origination fees and no credit insurance on these small loans, so they avoided the two pitfalls that plague the installment loan market while doing all three of those right as part of the trifecta. So that means that costs are spread evenly, prices are lower, and payments are affordable.
Alex Horowitz is Senior Research Officer of Pew's Consumer Finance Project. You can find the report, or at least a summary of it. It's called State Laws Put Installment Loan Borrowers at Risk at the Pew website. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for your time.
This year's midterm election is pretty contentious. To better understand the issues that are most important to Michigan voters, we've dispatched reporters and producers throughout the state to ask people two questions. What are the most important issues for you as a Michigan voter? And what concerns you most about our political climate right now? From now until election, we'll be bringing you those answers in a segment called Voter Voices. First, we'll catch up with a voter in Kalamazoo.
My name is Audrey Myers. I used to work at a yoga studio in Memories Bridal. Most important issue. As of right now, I really care about women's issues. Also, I believe that marijuana should be legal. I also think like the issues with homelessness and that kind of stuff that has been going on here is really important, and we need to figure out how to deal with it in a better way. What concerns me most? The racism and bigotry that they're so open about and talking poorly about women. I'm concerned about our president and how he represents this country as a whole to the rest of the world.
My name is Bass David. I'm from Ann Arbor. The most important issue to me is family values, because I think this generation has lost its moral compass. So we need to get back to the roots of moral, to reset our moral compass. What concerns me is that no one is talking. So everybody talks about what somebody else believes, but not talking about what they believe. Politicians are more partisan and argumentative, and they need to get back to introducing themselves so we know who we're voting for and not hearing from the opposition what the opposition believes.
Special thanks to Adam Reyes and Sarah Leeson for recording those interviews. Up next on Stateside, votes could get a historic neighborhood in Pontiac some much-needed cash for preservation.
You have older generations of folks that have lived there for decades. You have new residents that are moving in. You have Latino, you have African-American, you have old, you have young, you have gay, you have straight. You literally have a microcosm of the rich diversity of Pontiac all living in this neighborhood and working to try to revive it and hang on to that diverse story.
After the break, we'll hear about the GM Modern Housing Project in Pontiac. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. A historic neighborhood in Pontiac has been named as one of 20 sites across the country, which will get a shot at part of $2 million for restoration. Joining me now is John Bry. He's the Oakland County Main Street Program Coordinator. Welcome.
Hi there. How are you?
Just fine. Hey, tell me about this neighborhood. What do you call it and where is it in the city?
Sure. This is the GM Modern Housing neighborhood. It's a historic district listed to the National Register of Historic Places. It's a neighborhood of about 260 homes constructed by General Motors to house the massive influx of workers that it had coming into Pontiac in the early 20th century. It's located just slightly north and east of downtown Pontiac.
So I saw one picture of one house, and it looks like it's a bungalow. What are these houses? What do they look like?
Yeah, these houses are a variety of styles, popular at the time period. They were designed by a firm from New York City, hired by General Motors to lay out the neighborhood and design the houses. There are a variety of styles. Like you mentioned, one is sort of a craftsman bungalow. Another variety is sort of a Dutch colonial with that barn-shaped gambrel roof. Mm-hmm. Colonial revivals that are brick. They're a combination of brick, stucco, and wood homes. So they're all different variety, but as you drive through the neighborhood, you see the architectural styles repeating every so often on the different streets and the different blocks.
So tell me about the homes inside. What were they like when they were new?
They're very modest. Some of the homes were two bedrooms. Some of the larger homes were four bedrooms. They typically had a living room, a dining room, a kitchen, a full basement in most of them. But they were either single bathroom, three to four bedrooms, and the living dining room areas, and then the basement. So they were pretty compact and small, depending on the size of the families.
And I'm guessing a lot of these are plaster walls and hardwood floors.
Yeah, hardwood floors, plaster walls, wood windows, concrete foundations, cedar shake siding on the exterior in combination with the stucco, and almost all of them had slate roofs originally. And throughout the neighborhood, you'll see many of the houses still retain the slate roofs.
So in what kind of shape are most of these houses today?
A variety of them. They're in excellent shape and condition to others that have been vacant for a number of years and have been boarded up and mothballed, some of which are owned by Oakland County. You can drive through the neighborhood and see some that have been beautifully maintained, or in some cases, some of them are currently being acquired and restored, and others that are still waiting for a good opportunity to be restored and have been sort of mothballed and boarded up.
Yeah, about how many out of the 260 are boarded up or vacant?
About eight of them are currently boarded up and vacant right now, and those are ones that are owned by Oakland County that we're targeting as part of this grant opportunity.
So you've got this shot at part of $2 million through the Vote Your Mainstream campaign.
Mm-hmm.
What is that exactly?
Well, it's a partnership between the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the National Main Street Center, Delta Airlines, National Geographic, and American Express. This is the second year for this grant campaign that they've organized, and it's targeting diverse historic preservation projects that have a rich and diverse history about them from across the nation. And we were selected in a competitive process to submit the GM Modern Housing District in Pontiac. We were one of those 20 cities nationally that was selected, the only one in Michigan. And now it's into a national online voting campaign. And depending on how many votes the project in Pontiac gets, helps dictate how much funding we will get to help restore some of these long vacant homes that are potentially at risk of being demolished if we can't find some alternative strategies for them.
So did they tell you why your neighborhood made it onto the list of 20?
Yeah, they basically thought that the Pontiac story in general, as a community, as a diverse community, different races, the story of Pontiac in terms of rising up as sort of this old industrial city and now is going through this transition of finding its new path and new direction, but at the same time trying to continue to celebrate and embrace its diversity. And this neighborhood particularly really represents that this was always one of these working class neighborhoods that was very diverse in the beginning and continues to be so today. You have older generations of folks that have lived there for decades. You have new residents that are moving in. You have Latino, you have African American, you have old, you have young, you have gay, you have straight. You literally have a microcosm of the rich diversity of Pontiac, all living in this neighborhood and working to try to revive it and hang on to that diverse story.
Now, I went and looked at the contest site, and I've read some literature about this. There's one thing I still don't understand. As the votes come in, does this mean all 20, if they get votes, get some fraction of that, depending on the amount of votes, or does that mean just the top three, or how does that work?
No, so what the national organizers have told us, getting the vote out is crucial. We ideally need to land in the top 10 of those 20 cities in order for us to receive the maximum amount of funding possible in the grant. And then the communities that are below that top 10, it will start to descend in order in terms of funding they get and potentially run the risk of not getting any funding at all. So it's not a one-and-done type voting process. People need to vote every single day, and they can vote every day, and they get five votes every day when they vote, and they can give those all to Pontiac. And so it's crucial that we continue to push the numbers. And I've been pretty proud that we've landed kind of in the 13th spot of these 20 cities, and we have some major competition, but even communities that are much smaller than Pontiac have been in the top 10 currently. So we can certainly do this if people will support the cause and the project and the community.
Well, if you get a part of this $2 million, what are the plans for it?
We are looking into a really exciting project based on a model from Indianapolis where they have used a very successful approach of revitalizing some of their historic homes and neighborhoods there. Where we partner with the Michigan Historic Preservation Network that has created a building trades program to train people how to work in the restoration trades. Because rehabbing historic buildings is often different techniques and materials than the new construction. And so the GM Modern Housing Homes would be used as these working labs to train folks how to work in the restoration arts with older buildings and older materials and older techniques versus new construction, which is a high demand with all the revitalization going on in the greater Detroit metro. So these homes will be used as these working labs, and the grant would be able to pay the trainers, to pay the students, and to acquire the materials that we may need on bringing these homes back online. And the methodology that they have used in Indianapolis, that homes that people thought were beyond repair, and some people thought these were beyond repair, but they're really not. And it's a better strategy to rehabilitate these historic homes rather than demolishing them and just leaving vacant lots in their wake. So what will happen is the envelopes of the exteriors of these homes will be restored back to their historic appearance, and it will position them to be acquired for new homeowners but still remain affordable and in the market, because that's one of the keys. They really want to see the GM Myron Housing neighborhood remain an affordable housing option for folks.
I'm guessing you would really like to give the web address where people can vote.
I would. We actually created one specifically for the neighborhood, and it's simply GMMH, General Motors Modern Housing, GMMH.org. The GMMH website takes you directly to the voting page for Pontiac. You have to create a sign-in, you have to create a password, but once you're in the system, it's easy to keep voting every day.
That's John Bry, coordinator of the Oakland County Mainstream Program, talking about the GM Modern Housing neighborhood and the effort to get funding through the Vote Your Mainstream campaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
There was a late addition to the race for Michigan Attorney General. A former assistant U.S. attorney is running as an independent. His name is Chris Gravelin, and he joins us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Lester.
I want to start with how you got on the ballot, okay? You did not have enough signatures to make the ballot. You didn't even have half the required number of signatures. You filed a lawsuit, and a federal judge put you on the ballot. I'm wondering, what's that say about how you view the law?
I have a lot of respect for the law. However, if a law is unconstitutional, the people of the state of Michigan can rely on me to challenge it. And I viewed this particular law as being unconstitutional. No independent has ever successfully met the bar that the Democrats and the Republicans set. So that's why I challenged the law.
In Bridge Magazine, you were interviewed and you indicated the attorneys general have become partisan lawyers working for political aims. What did you mean by that?
The Republican and Democratic parties have taken a model that was first used back in the 1990s in a bipartisan way, where the attorney general sued the tobacco industry to get settlement to help defray medical costs, and have now broken that down into essentially Republican and Democratic attorney general associations that only sue on behalf of their own political disputes. You see that with Attorney General Schuette over the last several years, where he and several other Republican attorney generals have sued the Obama administration over the Affordable Care Act and EPA regulations. The Democrat Attorney General Association has sued the Trump administration 134 times. My question is, who's doing the work of the people? Consumer protection, actually getting resources to fight violent crime, opioid addiction, identity theft. That's what I want to do.
Governor Snyder negotiated with a Canadian pipeline company to build a tunnel 100 feet underground for twin gas and oil pipelines. That will take years to construct. In the meantime, the 65-year-old Enbridge Line 5 pipeline that lies on the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac is still there. What, if anything, would you do about Line 5?
I think what the next attorney general needs to do with Line 5 is to work with the governor, whichever candidate wins the governorship. There's been a lot of talk about the attorney general can unilaterally revoke the easement. I think that's basically a headline slogan. As soon as the attorney general would try to do that, there is federal legislation that also governs that pipeline. Immediately, Enbridge would bring you into federal court, seek injunctive relief, and it would drag on for a number of years. It's not as if the attorney general can shut it down tomorrow. So to say that you can, I think, is quite frankly misleading. And so what I would be doing is working with the attorney, with the governor, to make sure that the line is safe and to advance all of our legal options to make sure that that pipeline is either rendered safe or shut down while they're building the tunnel.
PFAS chemicals are being found in drinking water and rivers and fish. Governor Snyder asked Attorney General Bill Schuette to file a lawsuit against 3M, one of the manufacturers of a product containing a PFAS chemical. So far, Schuette has not filed suit. What would you do if you were in that place?
I would file the suit. I would enforce all the environmental regulations that are on the books. And if 3M is violating those, we'd be filing a lawsuit.
3M will tell you, we didn't dump this stuff in your environment. We gave it to manufacturers who mishandled it. Do you still have a case?
I mean, that's for my staff attorneys to come and advise me of, my investigators. At the same time, if the governor is heavily suggesting that you have a case, I think you minimally have to open up the investigation and move with speed. I think one of the biggest things is I think lawyers can drag their feet a lot. I'm not a big foot dragger, and I haven't been during my time as a federal prosecutor. If things need to be resolved, let's go get them resolved.
In this state, you can be fired for being LGBTQ. In some cases, you can be denied housing for being gay. You can be denied service for being gay. The Elliot Larson Act, the Civil Rights Act of Michigan, prohibits discrimination against a person based on religion, race, color, national origin, age, sex, height, weight, familial status, marital status. What do you think about expanding civil rights protections to LGBTQ folks?
Well, I think, first of all, I think in terms of how LGBTQ would be treated by my office, they would be treated with dignity and respect. We would treat all citizens exactly the same with respect under the law. In terms of the Elliot Larson bill, I think that's going to be an issue that the legislature needs to take up and needs to take a look at.
But the Attorney General has great sway in that he can advise on how things should be interpreted. And we've seen things from the Michigan Civil Rights Commission be interpreted by the Attorney General office as not being able to reach out and protect certain classes of LGBTQ folks.
I completely understand. I believe Attorney General Schuette just put out an opinion talking about that. At the same time, I think this is one that can best be taken up with the legislature as well. So in terms of, I want to be very careful because I think what happens a lots of times, and we see this both nationally and here in the state, is the legislature and Congress, when they come to difficult decisions, like to punt it to someone else. So on the national level, it's the Supreme Court. That's why you see the death match over Supreme Court justices. On the state level, they like to punt it to the Attorney General. I'm not going to be the rule of one here. I'm going to push back and say, listen, legislature, you need to take a hard look at, you know, and make those types of difficult decisions on, for example, on Elliot Larson.
One of the proposals on the ballot asks voters to make the recreational use of marijuana legal in Michigan. What are your thoughts about that?
While marijuana remains illegal under federal law, I think it's a bad idea to legalize it under state law. And I think it has a lot of second and third order effects that people don't think about. For example, most of the businesses are suddenly all cash businesses. And then when they go to try to put the money into banks, which are federally insured, don't take them because it violates federal money laundering laws as well. So you create a whole bunch of second and third order of effects about how do you handle this? So I'll be voting no on Proposal 1. With that being said, the way I view the Attorney General's position, any duly enacted law, it is my job to implement in the most intelligent and smart way possible. I will not be trying to thwart the will of the people. It's my job to enforce that law as well as I possibly can.
I like to ask this question of every Attorney General candidate I've talked to. Civil asset forfeiture is the practice of law enforcement seizing property suspected of being gotten through illegal gains, such as selling drugs. There might never be a conviction or even charges filed, but that property is still seized, and it's very difficult to get back. What do you think of that as a law enforcement tool?
Well, I'm very familiar with civil asset forfeiture. I used to work in the drug unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office. There is mechanisms to challenge when we seize money. We have to be very careful that it's not just a money grab from law enforcement. At the same time, what the practice is lots of times we catch the couriers with the large amounts of money, $600,000, $700,000. And the question is, do you prosecute the courier or do you seize the money and have them come and try to justify why they had the money?
What happens to due process in this?
They have due process. They can challenge it in civil law court as opposed to going to get the conviction.
If they're not convicted or even charged, though, why should they have to go through that process?
Well, here's the other option, that we just charge them. And then we talk about the rates of incarceration on people and only going after low-level couriers and putting people in prison. There is a process in which they can go through. It's civil. There's no conviction. If they want to challenge it, they can. The other route is, and we take away civil asset forfeiture, we're going to have to charge them, and then we will seize it under the criminal forfeiture provisions. And then that person will also be going to prison. And so I know there's been a lot of discussion about civil asset forfeiture, but there is a mechanism in which you can challenge it. Many people don't, because there's not a very good reason why they have $500,000 in their trunk. And so I think it's a useful tool for law enforcement that also avoids criminal culpability for the people who might be caught.
Chris Gravelin is running for Attorney General as an independent. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Lester.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we talk with Lisa Lane Gioia, the Libertarian candidate running for Attorney General. And tomorrow on Morning Edition with Doug Trabu, you can hear the Republican candidate, Tom Leonard. Still to come, the lasting legacy of the Burt Lake burnout that forced the relocation of a Native Indian tribe in northern Michigan.
They imagine that because the land originally was stolen from indigenous peoples, well, there's nothing we can do. No, there's much we can do, because in many places in this country, those same indigenous peoples are still there.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. As usual, on Thursdays, we're checking in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great. Your column today looks at whether it makes sense for a financially challenged city like Detroit to give tax incentives in support of the renovation of the Michigan Central Depot in Corktown. Why should the city give Ford Motor Company, which is sitting on about $17 billion in cash reserves, as you noted, a nearly $140 million tax savings break?
I think it's closer to 104, but I think it's a very legitimate question. And I think the simple answer is, what's the alternative? That train station has sat empty for 30 years. The owner of that train station for most of that time, the bridge mogul Matty Maroon, effectively did nothing with it. The tax revenue that it collected was almost nil. And you're looking at a situation where you could have up to 5,000 people paying city income tax. That alone would be a huge haul on an annual basis. Secondly, I think you have to look at the fact about what kind of economic spinoff it's likely to generate. And I think the feeling is already you're starting to see property values going up. There's a lot of excitement in the community. And thirdly, I think people need to realize that doing business in Detroit is not necessarily easy, even now. It's got the highest real estate tax rate on commercial property in the country, I'm told, by the Detroit Economic Development Corporation. And it's the income tax rate on personal incomes. So you have a lot of issues that continue to make Detroit more expensive. And incentives are an attempt to level that playing field and, to be honest, to reward risk. This is not the same thing as doing an investment in Southern California.
Yeah, I like the way you wrote that. It was pretty elegant. I thought you write that incentives are often necessary to equalize the investment disincentives embedded in the cost of doing business in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you write early in the part of the column, something is better than nothing. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, I've had conversations over the years with people involved in economic development in Detroit, and I remember talking to George Jackson, who headed the DEGC for a lot of years, and he made the argument, all I want is investment. You know, if I have to give away all the tax incentives, or at least some of the ones that he's allowed to give away, income taxes typically you are not allowed to abate, he says, I'm prepared to do that. I just want economic activity. Now, that was mostly pre-Dan Gilbert, so we're now in a different phase of development here. But a lot of these investments and these tax incentives are dependent on whether or not these companies create jobs. And if they don't create the jobs, you don't get the tax incentives. And so that's what I mean by something is better than nothing. If you get more jobs and you abate a certain amount of taxes on that activity, you're still getting something which is appreciably more than what you're getting now, which is effectively nothing. I mean, that is a historic structure, but it has loomed gap-toothed over downtown for 30 years empty. And if you can generate economic activity, and I think even city council, even the critics on city council, some of whom voted against this latest package earlier this week, have said they expect just that, and they think that the net is going to be positive for the city. I think what you're seeing here in Detroit is a realization that some of these things are actually starting to happen, and when people say they're going to invest, they are investing. It's really important for investors and business leaders when they invest to do what they say they're going to do, because if they don't, all that does is undercut their credibility.
It's interesting to be talking about tax incentives like this because the Illich family recently was criticized for not fully realizing the proposal for District Detroit development around the Little Caesars Arena after they got a huge package of tax incentives. Is getting some of what you hoped better than nothing?
Well, I would think so, yes, but I do think that speaks to the point I just made, is I think one of the things that's really, really important for business as they go through this process, and they do ask for large incentives, both from the city and from the state, is that they do what they say they're going to do. To turn around and change the plan in midstream and really change it into something that it was not when it was originally pitched really does not help. And I think that's a cautionary tale, particularly for Ford Motor Company. You know, what's really interesting to me about this is the Illiches and Dan Gilbert are at base local business people. They are people that have been known here. Their businesses now are far and wide. Quicken is the largest mortgage lender in the United States. Little Caesars is all over the world. But none of them are Ford Motor Company. That's a 115-year-old brand that is known in Russia, China, India, the UK, Germany, certainly the United States and North America. It brings a different kind of credibility to this whole process. And there's a certain risk. If you're going to say we're going to work with the community and we want to fashion this together, and then you turn around and do something totally different, I think that puts us back and would put us – and I think it would justify the skeptics who say, see, we told you. At the end of the day, these companies have to do what they say they're going to do.
Daniel Hiles is columnist and associate business editor at Detroit News. Hey, nice talking with you.
Thanks, Lester.
On a chilly morning, 118 autumns ago, the residents of a tiny village along a lake in northern Michigan were forced out of their homes and kicked off the land they had legally purchased. The residents were Native people, members of what was then called the Sheboyganing Band of Indians. There's some evidence Native people have been living at that site for thousands of years. But since that morning, on October 15, 1900, their land has been in the hands of others. And the descendants of those who were there that morning are still fighting for justice and recognition in the courts today. For the fourth story in his series, An Idea on the Land, Dustin Dwyer reports.
I'm standing next to a chain-link fence on a quiet road next to Burt Lake in Sheboygan County. Next to me on the other side of the fence is Ken Parkey. He has on a brown hooded sweatshirt, blue work pants, and a black cap with sunglasses perched on the rim. Parkey grew up around here, a few miles up the road. He's an elder in the Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, descended from the same people who were forced off this property 118 years ago.
Let me see if I can pull this up. I had a picture of just a while.
I get my phone out to find a picture online of what the village here used to look like.
Oh yeah, this picture right here. That's the village.
That's the village. They must have been this road right through here, right in this area.
So there would have been houses on both sides?
Mm-hmm. Imagine.
And the church must have been back over.
The church would have been up in here, up in that area.
The spot he's pointing to is just across the street, but it's private property now. Most of the area around here is. It's dotted with multi-million dollar homes along the water, every Michigan person's dream of a getaway property up north. But not where Ken and I are standing. This part is a cemetery, a small patch of land with white crosses and rows. The people who lived here before 1900 were Christian, converted by the French. They had a church and a cemetery. Ken thinks the cemetery used to be a lot bigger.
Yeah, but I swear to God that cemetery went over there a little bit farther beyond that road and goes down. And I think that was part of the cemetery myself. And they just put a road down through there.
And all these people know they're living on top of your ancestors?
Some of them do, some of them don't care.
I guess I shouldn't talk. That's just the way it is in a lot of America. I live in Grand Rapids. It's not that it's much different. It's just that here, you know where it is.
Uh-huh. Ken gives me a bit of a shrug. We stand and we talk for a few more minutes. Then he gets back to what he was doing before, what he's been doing since he was a boy, keeping the cemetery in shape. For now, that means mowing the grass. It's not news to anyone to hear that a group of native people were forced off their land by white people. But what happened on this piece of land was a bit different. The Burt Lake Band, then known as the Sheboyganing Band, had kept this land as a reservation after signing the treaty that gave most of Michigan to the U.S. government. Later, when the government was taking back some reservation lands, Sheboyganing leaders got money together and they bought the land outright. The governor of Michigan kept the land in trust. And because tribes are their own government entities, they generally don't pay property taxes. But in the late 1800s, Sheboygan County officials decided to assess taxes on this land anyway. And when the tribe didn't pay, the land went into foreclosure. That's when it was bought by a land speculator by the name of John McGinn. And when the native people still refused to leave, McGinn got together a group of white folks from town and headed to what they called Indian Village for a confrontation. One of the members of the group was the Sheboygan County Sheriff at the time. His name was Fred Ming. So McGinn, Ming, and the others came into the village on the morning of October 15th, 1900. The stories say the men of the village were gone that day. The white men ordered the women and children out of their cabins. They tossed the belongings into the road, and the men set fire to the homes.
I told you I knew something about irony, and I'll tell you what, I'll tell you irony.
Don Parkey is another descendant and a relative of Ken's. He sits at his kitchen table next to his wife, Nola.
When McGinn took his men in there and burnt down that village, they didn't burn down the church because, you know, that would be wrong.
Don is quick to a joke. Nola is quick to a laugh. He has a salt and pepper goatee and a shirt that says life is good. Her shirt is red with buttons. They both hold official titles in their tribal government for what's now called the Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. While we sit, Nola has a stack of papers on the table, the documentation of what happened that fall day in Burt Lake.
A lot of people haven't, they've never heard of this. And I think in a lot, maybe the state of Michigan likes it that way.
Because if no one hears about it, nothing has to be done about it. And there's lots that could be done, starting with the most obvious, returning the land. Much of what used to be the Burt Lake Band's land has been broken up into private lots with summer homes. It is waterfront property up north, after all. But some of it has also been bought up for conservation. A large part of it is now owned by the Little Traverse Land Conservancy. Another part is owned by the University of Michigan.
Would you say that at this point the members would like, would support and want this land back, or is it...
Gosh, yes. Oh, heavens, yes. That land down that they have, that's the reservation.
That's our traditional land.
That's their home.
But Nola and Don say the members of the Burt Lake Band aren't really pushing right now for anyone to give up any land. That's because they have their hands tied up with another fight. And this one is much more bureaucratic, much more difficult to wrap your head around. They're trying to prove they exist. Specifically, they're trying to prove to the federal government that the Burt Lake Band should be a recognized tribe. Members of the Burt Lake Band say they've always been a tribe. Their tribal leaders signed the treaties in 1836 and 1855 with the federal government. State leaders in Michigan treated them as a tribe. But officially on the books today, the Burt Lake Band doesn't exist.
The injustice is pretty obvious.
Bruce Hamlin is the current tribal chairman of the Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. He's a busy guy. I caught him on his cell phone. And he says recognition matters because without it, members of the band can't get the rights that were guaranteed to them in the treaties signed by the federal government. Those include the right to hunt and fish on public lands and other benefits that have been given to Native tribes over the years, including access to health care and school financial aid.
You know, when you sign a treaty, you make a promise, you're supposed to keep a promise. So all those things are important to us.
The problem of recognition for the Burt Lake Band dates back to 1934, when Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act. It was supposed to help tribes, but it also created a list, the list of federally recognized tribes. To get on the list, a tribe had to meet one of three criteria. And the one that got a lot of today's tribes recognized, having land. When the Burt Lake Band members applied in 1935, they didn't have land. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs never even responded to the application. The Bureau still hasn't. The band tried again to apply in the 1980s. Members waited almost two decades for a response, then were rejected. And in 2017, the Burt Lake Band sued the BIA. That case is still moving its way through the system, with another hearing scheduled for January. If all of this sounds exhausting, it is. This fight for bureaucratic recognition has been going on now for generations. Thousands and thousands of pages of documents, including detailed family genealogies, were turned in to the federal government.
It's almost a joke when you look back at it, at how long it's taken.
That's Nola Parkey again. She's the executive director of the Burt Lake Band.
I don't know. I just pray that it all goes good this time. Right. If it doesn't.
I have a sense that people won't quit.
Very good.
I'm getting that impression.
I don't think they will.
But the consistency is the one thing we have going for us.
There is one more little item in the history of the Burt Lake Band to consider. One more little avenue that might bring some sense of justice to what happened 118 years ago. After the cabins were burned that morning in 1900, and the people of the tribe forced off their land, there was an outcry across the state. The Detroit papers wrote about it. People in Lansing took notice. In 1903, the State House and Senate passed a joint resolution to try to help the Burt Lake Band, which at that time was called the Sheboyganing Band. One part of the resolution said, there seems to be at least a moral obligation upon the part of the state to restore the land to this band of Indians, end quote. The resolution called for the state to set aside up to 400 acres of public land for the band to use. Burt Lake Band members say that land from the state never came through. It's been more than a century. But they say maybe the state could make good on the resolution today. I want to end this story where we began the series 4 days ago, with the voice of Willie Jennings. Jennings is a professor at Yale Divinity School. He grew up in Grand Rapids. He is a Christian, and he has this idea about dirt, that dirt is what we came from. Dirt is what we share. Dirt is our land, our place, ourselves. He says, for our own sake, we have to look deeply at the history of places, city by city, and ask, how do we move forward together?
Now, you know, for some people, they imagine that because the land originally was stolen from indigenous peoples, well, there's nothing we can do. No, there's much we can do. Because in many places in this country, those same indigenous peoples are still there. And we ought to take very seriously what it means to think about that this land was taken from them. And we must have serious conversations about returning the land. Now, for some people, that's just outrageous. Oh, there's no way. But here's the problem. The problem of not taking seriously the history of a place means that no matter how moral or ethical or upright or Christian you might imagine yourself being, if you don't want to take seriously the history of a place, then at the deepest levels of life, you're living a lie.
That story was reported by Dustin Dwyer. To hear the previous stories in his series, An Idea on the Land, go to our website, michiganradio.org. There you can also see photos and hear an extended interview with Willie Jennings. Today, Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Lindsay Scullin, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Joy Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.